Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Reading now an excerpt from Watergate, The Corruption and Fall of Richard Nixon by Fred Emery. If 1971 was a non-election year for Nixon, there was no such thing as a non-political year. His memoirs make this plain. As each day brought the election closer, and as the competition heightened, the need for action and information became irresistible. I ended up keeping the pressure on the people around me to get organized, to get tough, to get the information about what the other side was doing. Sometimes I ordered a tail on a front-running Democrat. Sometimes I urged that department and agency files be checked for any indications of suspicious or illegal activities involving prominent Democrats. I told myself that we should come up with the kind of imaginative dirty tricks that our Democratic opponents used against us and others so effectively in previous campaigns.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me is the only person who aptly begins the minute that they are discussing with the word schmuck, is one of the most hilarious and just ridiculously talented film critics in the world, Bostonian critic for WBUR, and a stack of other places. My friend, Mr. Sean Burns. Sean, welcome to All the President's Minutes.
I'm happy to go anywhere you introduce me.
He's the best. Let's look. So many of the minutes we've started to discuss, we go off on massive tangents. And I know that Sean and I love to go on a many a tangent. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually try and keep to some form of discipline right now and dive straight into this minute. Sean, you'll hear, is an insane cinephile, and we'll sort of discuss. But let's get to Harry Rosenfeld, Jack Warden. Let's get to a shrinking Woodward in the face of the fact that he doesn't know who the special counsel to the president is, Charles Colson. And let's, you know, let's get to how Charles Colson's philosophy of to winning over the hearts and minds of the American people manifests in this minute. And then we're going to, then we'll come back and we'll talk about it.
Now we're going to have to fire this schmuck at once because he's so dumb.
Oh, who is Charles Colson?
The most powerful man in the United States is President Nixon. You've heard of him. Charles Colson is special counsel to the president. There's a cartoon on his wall. Caption reads, "When you got him by the balls, our hearts and minds will follow."
Howard Hunt, please.
One moment, please.
Howard Hunt here.
Yeah, I understand.
Hi, I'm Bob Woodward of the Washington Post.
Yes, what is it?
I was just kind of wondering why your name and phone number were in the address books of two of the men arrested at Watergate.
Good God.
You care to comment?
In view that the matter is under adjudication, I have no comment.
Jack Warden, when you got him by the balls, their hearts and minds will follow. I should have that on the studio wall. I should have that on the studio wall in my little home office studio here, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, Jack Warden, we don't have character actors like that now, right? I mean, that's why Bill Camp's in every part. He's kind of the only guy who can do that, just walk in. Like, he just relaxes into these roles like they're an old pair of jeans or something.
Yeah, it's just not, there's just no artifice. You know, he just comes and he's completely I always think about him in Dirty Work, you know, Norm Macdonald's little movie. Like he's like there's sort of Norm who just so beautifully is like, seems like he's in another time zone to every other human being in the world when he's around them. Like, and then you get like Artie Lang, who is very, 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 very funny. But Artie's like, as an actor, like as opposed to being a comic or natural when he's on the radio, because he's just like, his natural self is like some of the funniest, he's one of the funniest guys in the world. But it's like, but Jack Warden feels like he's in that world. Like when he's playing their dad, like he is their dad. Like there's no distance. He's just completely immersed in it. Just sweatpants wearing, gross dad. And you can totally tell that like he's the reason that, you know, it was one of the greatest bits of casting ever. And I think Artie Lang would agree, is like Jack Warden as Artie Lang's dad is like one of the best bits of casting ever. Forget.
And yeah, we were talking before about him and Shampoo. That last scene with him and Beatty in the morning is just, there's so many different ways an actor could have played that. And Warden comes in under the scene. You expect him to blow his stack, like, you fucked my wife and my daughter. And then, you know, it's totally calm. Like, how do you work? What makes a guy like you tick?
But you can tell, like, that isn't that such a smart bit of casting? Because anyone who'd seen Jack Warden up to that point is like, oh, shit. He's gonna 12 angry men, Beatty. It's all over. Yeah. Like, and then him to come in and undercut like that. But I think one of the things we did say off air was, I'm 100% sure that Beatty had that conversation in Hollywood in the '70s all the time.
They say right what you know. He told town, I'll handle this scene. You get the other part.
Rob, just put the pen down, man. I know you're okay at this, but I got this scene. There was this really silly, I can't remember where it was, whether it was the Golden Globes thing. There was Alex Rodriguez, the baseball player, with J-Lo at the Globes, I think, standing there at a table, and someone had said, like, in the wrap up of the evening, there's the crowd pan shots, and it's just full a litany of like TV and film celebrities. And there's this moment where Beatty is talking. Beatty's talking to J-Lo, and you can, and Beatty's standing up, J-Lo's sitting down, and A-Rod sort of standing up behind him. And there's a crowd of people trying to sort of make their way out of the theater. And you can see A-Rod sort of slowly moving in between the two of them to like do it. And someone just clipped it on Twitter. I have got to find it. But someone clipped it just right back on my bullshit, like as far as Beatty, you know, like just like trying to Mr. Steal Your Girl. Like, I just thought, God, that is too funny. But let's get back to this minute. All the President's Men, 1976, Alan J. Pakula. It is a complete and utter staggering masterpiece of morality and just people working really hard and hitting roadblocks and continuing to work sort of tirelessly. And this scene is just so perfect because we've had other scenes and we'll have other scenes with Bernstein, who's like a bit of a hound, as Hoffman plays him, and who's like, you know, listening into conversations through doors while he's casually having a cup of coffee, you know, trying to get in on stories and stuff. And you get to this moment where nice little bit of information's come through in the evening. It's come through into Woodward's, like basically while he's chilling out at home in his messy apartment, you know, H Hunt, W House, you know, oh, sorry, H at W H and H Hunt and Howard Hunt, W House. And so he comes in and starts making some phone calls. And the first phone call gets into this Coulson's office, which is the great introduction of the scene. But it then unfolds into this beautiful, long investigative scene where there's a whole bunch of dump of information. And it's just so beautifully put together. Because in so many, like, and the one movie that just drives me insane when I think about it is something like Attack of the Clones, you know, one of the Star Wars prequels, where every bit... It's the most egregious example of, there are so many conversation scenes where they're trying to move the plot, and George Lucas only knows how to, you know, have people talking to each other, standing and talking in the same exact way, shot with at the exact same range, and it's just a litany of digital backgrounds that are like changing the mechanics, or what he thinks is changing the mechanics of them just having a conversation, two people, but it may as well be two people sitting down at a coffee house and just talking. because it's just the same shot. But this is just a really masterful conversation.
Now, is this our first split diopter? I think it's the first one in the movie,
it
right?
It is the first split
diopter. I'm so proud I was here for the first, because there's about 200 more coming.
it's so great. You think about it, right? What a flex you do to go, I built the whole Washington Post. Like the people, right. You know what I mean? Like we built this in Burbank, you know, this thing, and like people at the Post walk in and go, Jesus, like you literally ripped our whole newsroom off. It's right here. And, you know, I think that's the credit to the landscape. It's that cool thing of like everyone else is just going about doing their thing. Presidents, where is it sat for you? I know you've obviously recently watched it for this show. And you quoted probably my favorite quote, these not very bright guys, talking about this, but where does it sit for you? You're a fan.
Well, when I was in high school, I went through a huge like Nixon obsession when I was in high school. And I read this book. Of course, I read The Final Days. I think it's part of like my inherent hatred of authority. Yeah, and actually it was passed down from my dad, who just despised Nixon so much. He hated the son of a bitch. And Nixon resigned on his birthday.
Oh.
So every year, you know, especially lately, the past 3 years, I'm like, we're hoping to get you the same present you got in 74, Dad.
It's just like, happy birthday, Dad. And then like written on a cake, and then underneath in brackets, impeach? ?
Right. But yeah, my dad had the entire, like, you know, like 10,000 page transcript of the Watergate hearings.
Wow.
Like the doorstop size, you know, you can buy it from, you know, the government, the National Archives or something. You know, he was just, he hated that son of a bitch so much. So of course, you know,
that's
when I got into it and realized, yeah. And thinking, geez, a lot of these fuckers are just corrupt. So yeah, I became obsessed with him. And then, you know, the first, when I finally saw the movie, I was like, oh my God, it's only the first half of the story.
Yes.
Where's the rest of the movie?
Yeah. Where's the rest?
And it took me a while to come around and realize it's absolutely brilliant, because everybody knows.
Yes.
And you've kind of been watching the same scene over and over again. And to watch the movie, it's like, how many different variations can Pakula and Gordon Willis find to come up on pretty much the same scene?
Yes.
And now they're going to get another name and they're going to confirm this. And we all know how it's going to end, especially, I mean, you think in 76, it was so fresh in everybody's memory.
Yeah.
So it's just really fun to watch. And from a cinematic point of view, all the overhead shots and split diopters and how many ways can they make, you know, they say you pay to watch Robert Redford read the phone book, and you like literally do.
He's so beautiful. He's the only actor who's like, hey, 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 this Academy Award winning movie. And nominated. I read the phone book.
Which is funny, because it's implied that like Hoffman's the one who gets laid all the time.
Yes. There's that Bernstein line. You're like, you're a hound. My girlfriend told me about you. And you're like, isn't it funny the lies we allow cinema to tell us? We're totally fine with this. It's one of the great things where I was in Heat, and to reference a convo I had with the great Manola Dargis, it was just like, she's like, for a movie with such deep authenticity, it's impossible to believe that a graphic designer, as in Amy Brenneman's character Edie, would have this apartment with this view in LA. It's just impossible to believe. And she's like, but that's just one of those romantic things we'll just completely let slide for a movie that's so deeply authentic. We'll just let it slide for the pure romanticism, and that's fine. And if the folklore was that he was that guy, that's great. Look, I want to come back to something that you said, because I think I just want to reinforce it for folks, and we may not have talked about it with a couple of, we definitely cover it on the show so far, but I just want to keep underscoring it, is, you know, these guys begin their investigation in 72. Nixon is ousted in 74. Like you said, the story of All the President's Men, the book, you know, takes you through, you know, from the very early days of their investigation, as it is covered in the film, and then past the tipping point that we just see in teletype and on the Telegraph coming through. And that's what weirds me out now, watching it more in 2019 and then 2018 and 2020, is you're watching this going, they're most certainly producing this while these guys are like still writing this, like while it's probably still in the manuscript stage, you know, what and the lore is, and you know, take it with a grain of salt, is like Redford's talking to these guys while they're writing these stories, saying, if you guys write a book, I want to buy the rights. And if when you guys write the book, like I'm going to, and being involved, like I'm going to star in the movie and I'm going to be producing it. And even as something as simple a touch as the original Watergate security guard, Frank Wills, is the guy who plays the Watergate security guard in this movie. So it's just one of those weird things where, you know, I think a lot of films talk about it, or we've, you know, you and I hear a lot about it because we're sort of in the film Twitter stuff, and you're hearing about the stories of like, oh, they got this guy to act in this. And even in Clint's recent movie, the train movie in Paris, where he's got the three guys who survived the terrorist attack playing themselves, you know,
that worked out
exactly. Like there's this fine line between stunt BS and legitimate sort of, I don't know, there's this legitimate sort of encapsulation of like taking real people who are involved and just sort of sprinkling them into texts and making this weird thing happen where you're like, such a rich authenticity in this and the way that it's being approached. It's just weird. It starts to be strange because it's so specific and it's so on point. And especially
while you're watching the two biggest movie stars in the world.
Exactly. That's what's strange, right? It's like almost everything around them. And and the last time
the guy from Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah. You're like, it's literally the exact floor of the Washington Post. And then you're like, oh, there's Jack Warden. You know, like it's one of those really strange things that I continue to find in this movie. And I love it. I really do.
Martin Balsam looks like he lives there. So, you know.
Yeah. Everyone looks like they live here. The great Robards, Jason Robards, who is going to get talked about many times on this podcast, was famously like hanging around, like did his most method acting thing I think he's ever done in his life, which is he hung around on set. He just used to sit. He used to sit in Bradley's office no matter what scene was happening, just with his feet up on the desk reading a book. Or like reading the paper, because it's like it'll just feel better if everyone knows that Bradley's here, you know.
Yeah, the boss is here.
So if there's something happening, but this minute specifically, it's great. Like you said, split diopters, and the biggest. This is what's so cool about Jack Warden. You can believe that Jack Warden could dress someone down, and and Redford's performance in this moment is so cool because he's an actor that like you do not associate with being dressed down ever. Or like when he is being chided, he's usually like, you know, like you think about Butch Cassidy and Sundance, also by Bill Goldman. It's like there'd be times where Newman's like chiding him and he's just like, he just stands stoic still, like he's just a wall. And the humor is the fact that he just doesn't respond to any of Newman's BS, but in this he's like shrinking, like the beginning of this scene, this massive guy is shrinking, feeling like a complete dummy, and it's just so wonderful. It's just a really great touch in this whole movie to see how he gets like dressed down so bad.
No, he's terrific in it. And it's great. The thing I love about the movie is there's no shit about their home lives.
Yes.
Or, you know, this is not like the girlfriend going, why are you working so late? All the scenes we hate, the movie skips over them.
Yeah.
And it was funny watching it again. It's really not concerned with you knowing what's going on. You just kind of get the gist of what they're supposed to be doing.
Yes.
And a lot of things aren't really clear. Well, I guess they have to find this out. Yes. But, you know, if I had to write out everything that happened, I would not be able to.
No.
I would have in high school when I was obsessed with this shit. But to explain how one thing gets to another, it's just mostly this incredible atmosphere. And what one of the great analog movies.
The best.
Like just notepads and typewriters.
Oh,
and I used to have this giant electric Olympia typewriter.
And Sean,
that I used to just pound on.
I am so jealous of that typewriters these days. I'm like, I want ink on my fingers. I want to be wailing on a keyboard. And
oh, it was so cathartic when you'd be writing, when you'd really get going on something, and then, you know, you slam the carriage return, and oh, my sisters probably could never sleep in the other room, and I'd be up thinking of fucking Hemingway.
Oh, man, I miss it.
Some horse shit about the Doors movie, probably, right?
And the balls on this guy Stone to have a real naked Native American.
Oh, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the best part of the movie. What's so weird is just how much I want to smoke in this. I just want to smoke all the time I watch this movie. It's so bad. It's like you really shouldn't, but this movie you just absolutely want. Yeah, but
what's... The ashes are everywhere. Movies, like, that's another thing. Movies never cover how cigarette ashes get all over the place, and they're constantly all over Dustin Hoffman's tie, the couch. Redford's always cleaning the ashes off wherever he was sitting.
And it's one of the first movies that it feels like, because it's so on point in its time, that he actually addresses it. Because in so many movies forever, like, you know, all the way back to, you know, Maltese Falcon or whatever, or like where Bogey's just like smoking so like constantly. It's like no one ever mentions the ash that's just going everywhere. But in this one, it's like so great to him. Like, is there anywhere you don't smoke? Like, is
there, in the elevator.
In the elevator. Come on, man. Give me a break. It is analog porn. I mean, in my day job and for preparation with podcasts and criticism, if I'm taking notes, a hell of a lot I'm writing down. I don't know what it is, but for me, like, the tactile thing of like having written the note, it just embeds the information in my head so much more than when I'm just simply typing it down, especially if I'm trying to retain.
Oh yeah. Well, it's a psychological thing. Cause you see it while you're
doing it.
And there's like a motor skill connected to what you're putting to paper. So,
but I do love that. It's also the truth of the notes that even though we are seeing notes being taken and a couple of things are legible, it then just devolves into multiple colored pens doodling like just scribble, because that's the chaos. You've done like an hour or two just non-stop phone calls with a whole bunch of dead ends, and you're not going to bother scribing the entire call of a dead end call. You're going to take the pertinent notes of the calls that actually open up and become something rather than just nothing. That's what's so perfect about it.
And it's so much fun to watch something, an investigation before the internet.
Yes.
You know, oh, they have to look all this shit up, and oh, now you got to go to the library, and you got to go to this office.
Where do you think that started? Because there's nothing more infuriating in contemporary things, even like the speed of the contemporary discovery. I know you can Google stuff, but one thing that I hate is, and maybe it's like a Bourne, maybe they mastered it in those Bourne movies of like, I need you to hack into this camera outlay. I just want to see someone have a conversation with transport. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if they're about just the agony of like, call transport, even the line change, call like transport and ask for the feed to those cameras and watching them go, where he's in there, we've got eyes on him, get those cameras up, how far away are we, 30 seconds, just something. Because I just don't, maybe I'm completely naive in a world where there's so much like NSA, like they can just listen, right. They're listening to this conversation, they're watching you poop, like whatever else they can do, like on your phone. But it's like, that there's no tension, and seemingly every government organization can just click a button and they have access to every single feed possible.
Well, this is why, right? The Coen brothers said they'd never write a contemporary thriller because it would just be people sitting in front of computers.
Yeah.
That'd be no fun. Because they're talking about, I think it was in Revelations, the part in the No Country for Old Men with the phone bill.
Yes.
Which should go into that great sequence where he's tracing the phone numbers. And they're like, yeah, now this would just be a Google thing and, you know, no fun to watch.
No, absolutely not. And even just the, you know, instead of that beautiful, glorious scene of him looking at his reflection in a TV, like a TV that's turned off in his reflection there and like looking around and scanning the room. He's already, he doesn't go to the house.
Yeah.
Or he opens the door and no one's in there and he just turns away. And he goes back and dials Google on his phone and he's searching immediately their phone records. It's kind of stupid. But here's the grind. This is what's good. And it's like in a modern context, it's nice to think that people, and this is what is so great about Jack Warden, maybe this scene and probably the whole movie, is that these guys aren't great journalists at the beginning of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And for Jack Warden to have faith that he may not be the best, like the most effortless guy yet, like he hasn't got his process down, but he sees something in his passion and his hunger to be good that he's like he's grooming him in the best possible way to be like, you can be actually really good at this job. And it's nice because he's so affectionately shitting on him at the beginning of this scene and he's not being fired. Like it's so dumb. Like I think it's like screenwriters have turned like life into these stupid shorthand moments. And when we see them like lean onto these tropes, you're just like, God damn it. And some of them can cheesily work. Like if the tone of the thing works, but I so much prefer this, like the grind, like this movie is the grind and you just get addicted to it and you can just watch it over and over again. This porn of the grind.
Well, if you think about if it were made today, how much dumb shit there would be about the other political reporters who wanted to take the story over. You'd have this whole dumbass rivalry, you know, in addition to all the scenes with the wife and the girlfriend at home saying, why do you work so much? And then, you know, they would lose a scoop to the hotshot political reporters. You can see the hacky version of this movie so clearly while you're watching it.
Yes.
And that's sort of the miracle of it, that they've just pared away, you know, and trusting the audience, like, you know, that we don't have to, we can get the gist of it without having to follow all the little details, not have everything over explained to us. And it's just about atmospheres and environments. I mean, the great Gordon Willis, oh, I got to see him at Harvard once, and what a wonderfully crotchety man.
Oh, tell me everything. I must know.
Oh, it was just,
who did he shit on? We need to know everything. This is the podcast.
The guy doing the Q&A had a rough night. Because it was exactly what you wanted him. He was just talking about nuts and bolts. And he's like, this is how you express an idea with the camera. And this is, and every time that anything got airy or, you know, sort of the way you would get at Harvard Q&A sometimes, he would just bash it right down.
No, so
completely pragmatic.
No, this is a technical art.
Right.
I can adjust things.
God, look at the fucking fluorescent lights in that newsroom. It's the most beautiful thing under those wide angles. I mean, they just go on for days behind them.
Yeah, it's like a football. It's like a football field of desks. Right. And they do such a, you know, they do such an amazing job of like every desk being a little bit of calculated mess. There's some islands of people who've clearly got some like OCD where they keep their desks really clean, but it's usually just like where it's just mounds of paper, copy desks, new editorial teams here, this everywhere. People like constantly on phones, hovering around TVs. It's just a stunning, like, it's like Monument Valley, John Ford Monument Valley, but it's a newsroom. Like it's just like flowing through just so perfectly. It's
When I interviewed Ben Affleck for Argo, he said his whole thing to the cinematography, I want it to look like all the president's men. I want just like trash and shit everywhere. I want every desk messy, overflow. Don't change the ashtrays.
Yes. That's a good note. That's a really good note as a director.
Oh, because you can smell that office. You can smell the stale smoke in the air. And, you know, everyone has horrible coffee breath. You can just feel it.
And my favorite thing is, and people are bumming smokes, and there's notes for messages. Come get your messages. And there's like 12 stacks of notes. You know, this is the thing. If for some reason the American lottery goes off, and, you know, or even the Australian one for that matter, because it has such a high thing, I just want to recreate the Watergate office, and we're just going to fill it and smoke in it and have paper. We're just going to create a publication and a podcast studio that is just paper and messy desks and corduroy jackets and smoking. And that's just it. It'll be just a team of people. And Matt Zeitz and Manola Dargis as the editors in pairing offices where they just have their feet on desks. Right. We only want to see you out here with a red pen.
Yeah, I mean, Matt just killing the first line of everything I write.
Oh, bless.
So my most surreal The President's Men story, since I can't stop name dropping in this podcast, I guess. So
this is
I'm
great.
At Sundance. I'm watching the a documentary about Dick Cheney. And 2 seconds before the movie starts, there's a seat that's been taped off. And one of the volunteers is like, that's where Redford likes to sit when he comes here. I'm like, oh, sure. Because, you know, it's like wherever you go, everyone's like, Redford's going to come to this movie. Redford goes to like 4 movies, the whole festival. You know, you never see him. It's like the Sasquatch. You get a Redford sighting once. He does like the press conference on the first day. And then he's just, you know, he doesn't want to hog the spotlight. I can understand. He doesn't want to hog the spotlight from the filmmakers. So when he wants to see a movie like he did here, he slips in like 30 seconds after it starts. And they just walk him into the seat. So the seat's kind of in front of me. So he's directly in my line of sight. I can't pay attention to the movie.
No, the movie's done.
Because
man.
I'm watching Robert Redford watch the movie, which is like, you know, I watched him read the phone book. For this. So I'm watching him watch this Dick Cheney documentary, and, you know, he's getting pissed. Every time Dick Cheney says anything, you get like the Redford that's shaking the head. And you're like, and then they cut to all the, you know, there's a lot of talking heads interviews. It wasn't a great documentary. I think it went to Showtime. But and then they start talking to Bob Woodward. And I realized that the real Woodward is on a movie screen.
Oh, Jesus.
And the movie Woodward is sitting in front of me. Like, I was so glad I didn't smoke before the before the screen.
Like, am I in a dream? Am I in a dream right now? Anyway, he would have had a wry smile for his old mate Woodward up there.
I think so. I mean, I was just so tripping out on the whole thing.
He would have probably...
And then it was a...
He would have moderately checked out.
The second the movie started, on the fade out, he was like, whew, out the back door. And, you know, I'm telling everyone, like, the projections, I was like, Redford was here. He was sitting right here. And like, yeah, sure he was.
Just for you, man. Far out. Look.
I watched Redford watch Bob Woodward, and it blew my mind.
I have to say, because it is the way of One Heat Minute Productions to throw things out in the universe that sometimes happen. God, I'd love to talk to Robert Redford about this movie. I think it's his best. I genuinely think from a producing perspective and from just everything that he did with this movie, this is like, there is just no way that they let a movie star of his caliber do something that has so much potential to fail so close to the events that happen. And there's also like with all the ingredients, and there's also no way that it should be allowed to work. Like, there's just no way that it should be allowed to work in any way, shape, or form. And in this, it completely works. Like, he just completely and utterly works every minute of it. So, yeah, I mean, look, Mr. Redford, Mr. Hoffman, Mr. Woodward, Mr. Bernstein, if you're listening to All the President's Minutes, here's your first invitation. Let's get to Bill Goldman.
All right, now here's where I'm kind of a heretic, because I am not the world's biggest William Goldman fan. I think this script is magnificent. I think it's incredible. But it doesn't have any of the usual Goldmanisms. It's not like, it's not snarky. It doesn't have all the goofy buddy humor. You know, it's very stripped down, and I wonder how much, you know, in my forensic auteurism I'm doing in my head was that, you know, Pakula just lining that stuff out. Because... But Goldman, I never got the Butch Cassidy deal. I remember, and I'm not alone on this. Gene Siskel got fired from his first job as a critic because he panned Butch Cassidy in the Sundance Kid.
Oh my God.
And I'm sorry, ladies. I hate the Princess Bride. And this Goldman formula of like, anachronisms are funny. Like, I'm going to have cowboys, but they talk like people from 1968. And he kicked a guy in the nuts. And then like, oh, it's a fairy tale, but they're all Borscht Belt comics. None of it works for me. Like, and then I read, you know, everyone.
But you have that the Ghost in the Darkness tattoo that you haven't shown people for this podcast.
I remember enjoying that movie quite a bit. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it since it came out. No, the thing though, those books he wrote though are really like, you would think that Butch and Sundance, like that movie cured Legionnaire's disease or something, because like, the way he and he publishes the whole screenplay in the middle. Like, when I decided to have Butch kick the guy in the nuts, I knew I was changing the face of cinema forever. And then the choice to have them say shit when they jump, it's like, oh, you're so daring. What would we have done without you?
I love your snark. It's the best. I genuinely think this is his best script too. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, in a generation just before us though, has like this incredible impact of like, you know, mm-hmm. people like Fincher and Aaron Sorkin, and then some of those other mentees of Bill Goldman. Like, it is the seminal movie. It is the game-changing movie. And for them, it's like the movie that made them want to be filmmakers. It's that weird thing of like, it's right then, 69, still technically in New Hollywood, but it's like the blockbuster of the New Hollywood era, if you like. It's had such a profound influence. And I go back and I'm not quite as hard on it as you are. Like, maybe it's because I'm a fan of like revisionist Westerns just in general of this era, even though like a lot of people forget that like in 56, John Ford made The Searchers, which is the revisionist Western. And people are like, oh, all these revisionist Westerns in the 60s and 70s. And you're like, hey guys, John Ford like did it. Like he did that and you're all just chasing that. And then like Marty makes, you know, Taxi Driver, which is that too. And you know.
Yeah, sort of every Schrader script and watch Hardcore again the other night. You know, like, oh, Schrader made The Searchers again.
Exactly. So it's already kind of been done. But I do like a revisionist Western, but I do get your point of like, for me, this movie is the pure execution. Because there's no...
The other Butch thing too is it's based on the same... Butch Cassidy is based on the same story as The Wild Bunch.
Yes.
You know, they're both fictionalized versions of the same gang. Sorry, Butch's gang was called The Wild Bunch, and I'm a Peckinpah guy.
Yes.
You know, that's my version of it.
Yeah, look.
Same year too, right?
Yes. Yeah, some people like The Dark Knight and other people like Heat because it's the same. It's kind of the same. One's got Batman and the Joker. The other has Al Pacino, Robert De Niro. Like, it's just, you know, you each have your preferences and you decide which ones. And, you know, and particularly with this story, you know, All the Presidents, there are crummy, you know, TV movies that are made about this story and these characters. And
Spotlight?
I think Spotlight's about something else, but I think McCarthy...
Oh, I thought you said crummy TV movie and I just jumped right to...
Yeah, I don't.
I'm sorry. I'm a heretic as a Bostonian here because I gave Spotlight 2.5 stars. I thought it was one of the most visually underwhelming films released that year.
It's got great performances and there's very good chemistry, but I agree with you. I don't have the same visceral reaction. Like I was talking earlier to Maria Lewis, who's one of my dear friends, author, writer, you know, film critic too. And she's like, oh, I know I watched Spotlight on repeat. She's like, I love Spotlight. And she's like, I really like All the President's Men too, but Spotlight is better for me. And a few people I've spoken to, like Spotlight resonates with them. I'm not sure if it's the content, like whether it's the content of the story or, you know, they're not as
It's got to be because it can't be the visual.
I'm much more of like, you talked about this movie being all atmosphere and so many times like doing the same grind of the same process over and over again and the talent, because you can imagine if it wasn't Pacula paired with Willis, how boring could this movie have been? It could have been the most boring movie of all time. And I think with Spotlight, the content sort of hopes to get you through because it is like so inflammatory and so crazy, and that's where you can still hang on to it. But there's no library scene in Spotlight. There's none of this beautiful split diopter grind. There's not the agony of like, or like strategizing in a Macca's that's just full of people, like, you know, and then going back out into the grind and then the music playing and just this presence of like this whole city is just this massive, rotten, corrupt place. Like that is just like all the good people are in here, like who are surviving. They haven't got long to go because it's just going to infect you. Yeah, Spotlight doesn't have any of that.
That's another thing that struck me too, watching it again. The incredible smallness of Woodward and Bernstein. They're never given the hero shots of you would expect from movie stars of that caliber.
No.
And there's constantly with the overhead shots and the camera pulling back wide. You know, you're always expanding to take in the city around them and realizing how like infinitesimal these two little, they look like bugs in all these overhead shots.
Little bugs
going. And they're going to bring the whole thing down.
Going through all these stacks of places and they're just as inconsequential as everyone else going about their day. And it's just that they kind of happen to be working 20 hours a day, you know, basically nonstop in that way. But one thing that I think, you know, we've done it's in you've with your incredible stories. There has been a revisionist history in and of itself with All the President's Men and Bill Goldman as a result of his brilliant writing about Adventures of the Screen Trade and then What Lies Did I Tell? And so I love that you said like there's people literally have done the forensic examination of like, did Bill Goldman write this script? You know, because Redford has said famously that he and Pakula like did lots of edits or maybe rewrote it. And I think what's great is like, I think Bill Goldman wrote this script and I think the forensic boffins on the internet have discovered, like they pretty much have done it, but it's just that's where people, you go, if you want to learn what a director does, watch Pakula at this time and then read the script, because it's not on the page. It's in his head.
Right.
It's not on the page. It's in his conception of how the scenes need to flow and how the actors need to relate to one another and how you pair back a scene or take away a line or, you know, get someone else to stumble into someone's line to give it that organic chemistry. And it's like, he's the guy that's behind the lens going, no, we're going to do it like this. We're going to make it like this. We're going to basically do kind of what I did in the parallax view, except it's going to be the real world. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to be the real world. We're going to try and make it as organic and strip back as possible.
Yeah, the thing, you talk about Goldman's writing about film. He used to have that column in Premiere.
Yes.
And it used to make me crazy because the one that really got the bee in my bonnet was who's going on and on about how Martin Scorsese doesn't know how to tell a story. Now, you and I have podcasts. I always go to the barricades when people talk trash about Marty. But he wrote this whole thing trashing not just Gangs of New York, but every Scorsese movie about how unsatisfying dramatically Taxi Driver is. The King of Comedy. He just eviscerated all these. Now, Goldman had a movie in theaters at that time that he had written, and the movie was called Dreamcatcher.
Oh.
And I believe it was a couple of years before he'd written Absolute Power, which is one of the dumbest movies I've ever seen. Now, you've got your name on those, and you're out there going, that Scorsese guy, he doesn't know how to tell a story. Like, have you seen Dreamcatcher? There's a part when Thomas Jane answers a gun because it's a phone with a psychic message from his friend. And, like, the gun makes. It's John Wayne's gun given to Morgan Freeman to help fight the aliens. And he answers the gun like a phone and says, Jonesy, I knew it would be you. Well, who did you think was calling on the gun?
Who did you think was calling on the gun?
Oh, like, oh, man. Shit, it's a robocall again. They want to know who I'm voting for.
Oh, God. I forgot that movie. I think I blanked it out. Because as soon as Damian Lewis was talking to himself, one in the American, his really generic accent at the time, which sort of sucked back then, but he's figured it out now in Billions. Like, he's figured it out. But back then, it was terrible. And then he's like, he'd go from that into like, Jonesy. And I just remember him doing that, and I was like,
what? Oh, yeah, it'd be a feet British villain named Mr. Gay.
What even?
Mr. Gray, but they call him Mr. Gay.
What is even this movie? Yeah, it's really strange. It's funny, you know, it's funny.
That's a bizarre film because it's like super budgeted, like Lawrence Kasdan, John Seale shot it. Like, it looks really expensive and nice.
Yes. And has a lot of like actors on the up, you know, it's like all those guys on the upswing as far as career. You can tell that they're casting for, oh, these guys are on the upswing. So this should be like a really ripper. It's really funny how people can be prescriptive about the way that one film does work or doesn't work. And like, I would totally hear a criticism of Gangs of New York and be like, oh, it's a not a satisfying story, and go, all right, well, let's unpack that. Like, tell me what you're saying. But then to go on and make more sweeping generalizations that it doesn't work ever. It's like, wait. Are we talking about Gangs of New York? Because let's just go back. Let's finish the conversation further. Because anything you've got to say about the lack of satisfaction in Goodfellas or Taxi Driver or Mean Streets, or Raging Bull, like maybe the greatest.
Oh, Raging Bull was a big bugbear for him. Like, you know, that doesn't give the audience anything they want.
And it's not meant to.
Well, I know. This is why I hate industry columns.
Yeah.
This kind of shit.
It was a fun industry column, though. It was fun because also one thing you do have to love about Goldman with that is that, like, he was sort of, you know, he was not at his most prolific period or his most critically lauded period at the time that the column was, like, hitting its absolute heights. But you do kind of have to love that someone can be in the industry and then also talking shit about it. You have to have that love about it. Knowing you, it's like, I do like that people can be deeply candid, like, in it. Like, they're in the system, and also be like, you know what? It's not always hunky-dory here. It's not always fun to have these conversations. You know, it's not always fun to be in this.
Oh, no, industry. Right. I wish he had better taste. I mean, I love what he's doing.
He's a great writer, but I wish he had better taste. You know what? He executed greatly on this. And it was so funny. This is the movie he said he would never go back and do again because of just the pressure, the interference, the egos, the time, you know, the Nora Ephron coming in and having a crack at scenes, and Redford and Hoffman wanting their own stuff, and obviously then Pakula having a very particular vision, all of that stuff.
Well, the structural brilliance, I mean, you'll hand it to him, because just the idea to end on their big fuck up.
Yes.
You know, that's like where the second act is, what do they call it, the all is lost moment in screenwriting manuals.
Yes.
And that's where the movie can end, because you know everything's going to work out. So yes. We don't need to sit through all the rest of this.
No.
And you have a wonderful monologue of it by Robards that closes it out. And you're like, yes, I don't need anything else. No, we're good.
No. And I just love watching these guys in the newsroom working. Gives you that great little bit of hope. they're just grinding. We're just going to keep writing the shit out of these stories. We've gone through all this stuff. We've got this down.
Yeah, the inauguration's on.
The inauguration's on. People are watching, and there's something so great about that. We get
the role of the television in the movie is really funny too. It's always this ironic counterpoint, and like everyone's staring at it, and it's saying something that's just patently false, or it's a stupid, misleading thing. And you know, TV is this sort of villain looming over in the corner.
But also there's a couple of times where TV does do the right thing in this movie in the archival footage, and it's because it's giving someone a platform who has no time for the newspapers. Like, you get like one of the politicians or whatever that's sitting down and then being grilled by a TV anchor. So today in the Washington Post, they accused of this, and it's like, these are thousands of man hours, and we did all this investigation, and we did this. And then the question was, thanks to the TV anchor, did you know this? And he goes, no, I didn't. And it's like, there's that great moment where it's like, oh, there is some, the power is when the platform gives you the big targets, but you ask the right hard questions of like, why didn't this happen? And then they kind of get stuck. And that's where you can see these guys getting skewered on the national stage in the most digestible format. You know, you don't have to read countless pages of the Post. If a good journalist has a political leader on there and asks the right grueling questions, they're great. Man, this is a good movie.
So I know you got into it a little with Bilga, but where are you on the Post in the Spielberg film?
I really like, I like the writing of that movie. I like the performances. I especially like the faces because it's got a great lot of character actors that are just littered through this movie. But I think that for me, it's just a more dramatic telling. Like, Spielberg is flexing a different set of dramatic muscles, and it just feels like, for me, it just doesn't work because I like the anti-drama. I love this movie so much that I love the anti-drama of this. And so with Spielberg, he's a much more painterly, melodramatic brush in some instances, like underscoring with Williams and that scene with Streep sort of walking out of the courtroom at the end. I just, it did that. That just didn't jive with me. It's an entertaining movie, but it's just a bit too, you know, when you see someone nursing the papers on the plane and there's like a Dutch angle, like an overhead Dutch angle, like down, in the actual column of the plane. Like I just was kind of a bit, it was just a little bit underscored of like over dramatics. And one of the things from going from, you know, some of my favorite movies are really different on this, but like with Heat is so hyper stylized, and maybe this is like the complete opposite way that I appreciate movies, is that this is effortless and anti-dramatic, and the drama is in tension and in silences and in reactions. Like even in that moment, in this exact scene that we talk about, when Warden's Harry finishes the sentence of like, he's got a plaque on his wall that says, when you got him by the balls, the hearts and minds will follow. There's this beautiful moment that Redford gives, and that Pakula gives Redford, where he looks at him and his eyes, all the way that I read that his eyes do this, he sort of goes, is this for real? Like, is this for real? And then when he, and then when he cognizantly like understands, oh, this is for real. And also, oh shit, this is who we're dealing with. He then gets this sort of bit of steel in his jaw, a little bit of a clench, and he turns back into the end of the scene. And so just little, there's not enough air and not enough anti-drama for me in the post. And that's more of a stylistic choice of how Spielberg was constructing the story. Maybe it was the way that he, in his head, tried to differentiate himself. You know, he loved presidents, but maybe didn't want to look like he was aping presidents.
Well, I think, no, because it's like a 30s newspaper comedy for most of it. Like, that was the big shock when I saw it. I thought it was going to be this very self-serious journalism as important. And it's Spielberg doing Howard Hawks half the time, where he's trying to see how many people he can get on the phone at once in one scene. It becomes this contest, where like when he's like rustling them all in and out of Hanks's house, and the kid's got the lemonade stand going, and it becomes this great little, you know, it's, I agree with the melodramatic stuff in the movie didn't work as well at all for me, but just, you know, Hanks in a newspaper office screaming at everybody, talking over
that, all of that stuff is great. All of that stuff is great. And for me, it was just more the style, whereas like the aesthetic and the style.
And it almost doesn't quite fit with the story they're trying to tell, because it's a very serious story about a war that killed a lot of people that could have been prevented. And we're just running around with Marilyn the caftan. They're in and out of the parties.
But I think that like, I think that that's all, like, I think that's ultimately where they're going, is like, maybe, you know, especially those sort of revelations for himself as Bradley personally later, is like, what relationship have I had with politics that has maybe made us be too chummy with this office and this idea. Mm-hmm. And even if we are mates with him,
he's talking about Jack.
Yeah.
Even Jack.
And that, like, completely surrendering to the idea that, no, this is not our game. Like, people might like us, they might see us, they might respect us, but when they're a story, there's a completely different outlook. I actually that's one thing I deeply love in the post, is that outlook of like, hey, we're journalists. We can be friendly with these people and we can be cordial, but we cannot be friends if they're the story. They're the story. You know, this kind of sucks. It's not being an investigative journalist
You can't have Bob McNamara over the house anymore.
That's exactly right. Like, because they're going to be the story. You know, you have to choose that. So it's kind of a life. I was a little bit more on the stylistically. It didn't jive with me as much. But I should, you know, but also that's because I've watched this movie, All the President's Men, that is, like hundreds of times. And I've probably watched The Post twice, and I could probably do with another, I could probably do it with another watch. And I watched them pretty much close to its release, so with all that familiarity, but maybe I should just jump back in and check it out.
And of course, the best All the President's Men remake is Zodiac.
Yes, exactly right. Especially the agony. And even, And David Finch is like, oh, you want an ending that, you know, is just sort of a cliffhanger that is not specific? You know, hold my beer. He's on my beer. Just, you know, a freaking guy,
yeah,
being,
especially
a guy being interviewed in an airport bathroom, basically, is like, yeah, that's him. He killed
him. And that first hour in the newsroom, you know, it's the same fluorescent lights. It's the same shitty desk.
Beautiful. And, you know. What a stunner. Yeah, the Chronicle. I love that. And that opening shot, he just was, that's, you know, that's such a Fincher thing, but it was so beautiful. The mail cart through that office is just such a great way to get into that world. And again, desks are just mounting with crap, papers everywhere, scribbles. Gray Smith's great because obviously he's cartooning all the time. So there's just little cartoons of every single thing all over the place.
The last adult Downey performance, right?
Oh, he did do The Judge, and I am actually deeply a sucker for that movie because of my daddy issues. But that's another topic. Wow.
That's a long picture. We'll do that another time.
But you know, we talk about Zodiac too, but again, Fincher, love Bill Goldman, favorite movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I think Fincher was more of a Pakula guy, I would assume, just because of,
you know, especially
in terms of the lighting scheme.
Yeah,
he hates eye lights as much as as much as Gordon Willis. Why are you shining a light on their eyes?
Oh, so perfect. Well, I can't really think of a better way to end than your Gordon Willis, why are you shining the light in their eyes? Mate, thank you so much for being a part of all the President's Minutes and going down. Look, this was your biggest name drop podcast ever.
I know. I don't know how I can ever top this. Too many anecdotes.
You watching Bob Woodward from this movie, watching Woodward, and your head not.
I'll never top that experience. Like,
if you were going to file a review,
the most surreal thing.
If you had to file a review for that movie, I would just love seeing you get outside and just call your editor and go, I just didn't even watch a frame of that. Like, I
would have to write like what Robert Redford thought of every line. Mr. Redford rolled his eyes.
Mr. Redford rolled his eyes at another Dick Cheney quote.
He nodded his head approvingly at the filibuster. Then the resolution passed and he shook his head.
Oh, God. Mate, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes. You're the best. And I hope that you enjoyed, as part of One Hit Minute Productions, Xander Berkeley talking about Ralph.
Marvel. Sit down!
Sit down! A huge thank you to the incredible Sean Burns. He is hilarious. He's extremely talented and articulate. And if you want to find his great and sardonic Twitter, it is at Sean M. Burns. You can follow all of his stuff there, and you can even go to his website, which keeps an archive of everything that he does, at splicedpersonality.com. Splicedpersonality.com is the best place to find Sean. Thank you so much again for listening to All the President's Minutes and anything on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and producer of Increment Vice, as well as everything that's been happening on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. If you want to follow me, simply go to at OneBlakeMinute on Instagram and on Twitter, or to OneHeatMinute.com to find out everything that's happening with the show and about the show. If you guys want to support us, we have a link on OneHeatMinute.com to our Patreon. If you can spare even a couple of bucks a month, the cost of a coffee a month, you are going to be contributing to this show, the amazing Increment Vice, and any other amazing shows that are a part of One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much in advance. If you can't support us, you don't have the cash, that's totally fine, but please subscribe, rate, review, and share the shows. We would love, if you are digging the show, share them with like-minded film folk around the place. Thank you so much once again for listening to this episode. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes and another episode in the One Heat Minute Productions feed. Very soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
JCPenney is your one smart shop for back to school. More fashion, bigger savings. Plus thousands of deals under $20 for you and your family. Find everything kids need, from backpacks to blue jeans, uniforms to undies, and high tops to haircuts. For the teen and college crew, we've got even more. From cargos to crop tops, hoodies to hair care, perfume to Puma, and towels to toasters. Get back to school ready in one affordable stop. JCPenney, make it count. Offers valid through 7/28.